David, and when you think of legacy, I'm not exactly sure what goes into your mind, but I know that in mine I have a little different idea, but it's one that is used quite a bit today that's a bit different than the dictionary definition of legacy. Still a standard definition, and the first definition of legacy for most dictionaries is, you know, the idea of inheritance. It's the passing on of goods, money, and property to another. And so the legacy is what we have then to pass on to our heirs. I don't know if it came from the idea of, especially, you know, not too many decades back, that really most people would get to the end of their life and they might sit their children down and their family and they might say, you know, I really don't have much to give you. And I'm going to be leaving this life probably in not too many more years. But what I have is a name. And I have kept this name throughout the years honorable. And I have kept it to a degree that it carries the idea of respect. And so I give my name to you. I'm going to leave that to you, and I'm going to leave an honorable name to you. And I hope that you, you know, would not squander that. And so I kind of wonder if maybe that is where the idea a little bit more of today's legacy, and that is, you know, your story, what it is that you leave behind as far as the life that we have led. And that then, you know, the history of us becomes, in a sense, our legacy. Now, you start getting older, and I'm not going to tell you when that is. Maybe I'm there, maybe I'm not. And, you know, because I'll be the one that decides, I guess, you know, and or God, but I mean, before I determine it, he might already have decided. But nonetheless, you know, as we get older, it may be a little bit more of a reflection back upon our life, and we're kind of thinking, okay, so what is it that I'm leaving as far as my story? What is my history? You know, what is my mark in the life of people? And how will they remember me? And will my mark be upon them an impression, you know, that they would want to emulate or one of which that they would want to avoid, you know, type of thing? And so, no, I didn't say me personally. I'm just speaking editorially. I'm, okay. But anyway, okay, so I'm there. So I'm thinking about, okay, so what is it I'm going to leave behind? But now you younger folks, and I'm not talking just about, you know, the teenagers. There's a number of you, you know, that are yet, you know, looking at life and you're making your mark and you're trying to think, you know, okay, what am I going to make out of life? And you know, what kind of story am I building? What kind of story am I going to build? And what am I going to accomplish, you know, in life? And what are my goals? Well, fortunately, our lesson this morning kind of has, you know, two different characters that most certainly both lead different legacies, as you're familiar with these characters, I am sure, Saul and David. But we also kind of look at it from this perspective of Saul, who, though we are at the beginning of his reign as a king, we're told that he's 40 years old at this point, and he, you know, is kind of at that dividing point. And as being a king, he can most certainly be looking at, you know, what kind of legacy am I going to leave as far as being a king? Or he might just already be thinking, well, you know, I'm king. I've arrived. I'm here. I'm there. And being king, I'm going to be able to pass that on to my sons. And they'll be able to be kings too. And so from this time forward, everyone will know that the family of Saul is the family of kings, you see. And so he might be thinking like that. I don't know. But then there's David. He's just a young man. He's just an early teenager, probably, at the time that we are introduced to him. And so, of course, he has before him yet, you know, a life to build. He has a story yet to make. He has a mark yet to impress upon the world. And what we can notice is really is that their character is that which really determines their legacy. And so as we look at Saul's character, and that's really more what we know him by, but we also do know what he left behind. But when we look at his character, we can kind of go, well, is that really what I want to be? You know, is that the kind of person I want to be? And, of course, we can also then look at, well, the finished product. You know, what was left behind. And so what we are looking at then is the life that he led and the kind of character that was developed in this man Saul. Now, it's not going to happen. You're not going to get the scripture references. All right. I'll have to figure out what I did wrong on that later, but I know that I can't save it in PPXT because so I do it in just the old standard PowerPoint, but it's not going to bring it for me. So just listen carefully. I'll give you the scriptures. We're going to have a number of them this morning. But in 1 Samuel chapter 13, where Al read for us here this morning, we find that Saul's fear reveals a lack of confidence in God. And so that tells us something about his character. We find that he is a man who's not trusting God's plan. He has been told, yes, you know, the Philistines are coming after us. Yes, they are pressing us. They have apparently pushed Israel over the bluff, not literally as far as, you know, pushing them and them falling over the bluff, but in other words, pursuing them to the point to where now that they leave the highlands just above the Jordan River and they drop down into Gilgal, down at the shores of the Jordan River. And this is 2 years after Samuel had been at Gilgal with Saul and had anointed him to be king, and there had offered sacrifices, and there the people rejoiced. And now here they are being pressed by the armies of the Philistines, and they then are worried because, and Saul's worried because his soldiers are leaving. They are hiding. Some of them have even gone over into the eastern shores of the Jordan. And in a sense, they've just already admitted defeat. And so here's Saul, like, what's going to happen to my army? The enemy's coming after us. And Samuel hasn't shown up yet. And he told me he'd be here now on this seventh day. And he hasn't arrived yet. And everyone's, you know, fleeing. And so, you know, he takes it upon himself then to offer these sacrifices. And don't have time to get into so much. Did he literally do it himself? Or did he have a priest with him? But it doesn't make any difference because Samuel said, I, as the high priest, am going to be the one that's going to be there, and I'm going to offer these because God's charged me to do this, and God's told you to be there. And so when Samuel gets there, even though he does get there on the right day, it's just later than what Saul is wanting. Saul's been worried. So Saul has failed the test, in other words. He hasn't trusted God. And he went ahead and he offered these sacrifices. And just finishing that, here Samuel shows up. And Samuel rebukes him and says, you know, why haven't you trusted God? And so he says, because of that, God's going to take this legacy of your sons being kings away from you. You'll be the only king of the family of Tish. You'll be the only king of the family of the Benjamites. And so God has taken that from you. Now, over in Hebrews chapter 3 and verses 18 and 19, we see this clearly spelled out when he says, "And to whom sware they he that they should not enter into his rest, but they that were disobedient?" And we see that they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. Now, which is it, unbelief or disobedience? I mean, he says right there in both of those, you know, you didn't enter because you weren't obedient. No, you didn't get to enter because you didn't really trust me. Well, we understand faith to be actually the action in compliance with the will of God. And so that's obedience. In other words, you trust God enough, you know, to be obedient unto Him. And so we find here in 1 Samuel 13 and verse 13, Samuel says, "You have not kept the commandment of Jehovah thy God, which he commanded you." So you see, Saul was disobedient. In fact, we find that Samuel tells him that, disobedience as rebellion, that it is, you know, has a terrible consequence to it. It's the same as practicing witchcraft. And so we find then that Samuel says to Saul, you've failed that. You haven't lived up to that. So Saul, remembers, been a king for 2 years up to this point. And he still hasn't really devoted himself to God. He still doesn't fully understand the priesthood, the sacrifices, and approaching God and coming before God. He still doesn't fully, you know, grasp the idea of just trusting and taking God at His word. In other words, Saul's really kind of a profane person. He doesn't understand the value of things that are holy, things that are, you know, righteous. Now, we find that God has another task for Saul. And Samuel, when he comes to tell him this task, Samuel tells him, as recorded in Samuel 15 and verse 1, he says, "Jehovah sent me to anoint you as king over Israel." And so he says, "Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice of the words of Jehovah." Now therefore listen to him. Now, some time has passed since the battle that took place and the victory that Israel finally did win there. But now God has charged Saul with going and doing battle with the Amalekites. And so we find then that Samuel says, "Now remember, it's God that sent me to anoint you as king. It's God that chose you for that position. So listen. Listen up. Listen to His voice. Do what He says." But then, as we are familiar with the events, we know when we get down to the 19th verse that Samuel comes and he says, "You know, I hear sheep bleating and I see all of these goods and things from the Amalekites, and God had told you to go and utterly destroy it all." And so he says there, as recorded in the 19th verse, "Wherefore did you not then obey the voice of Jehovah?" Now the sad thing is Saul may have actually thought he was obeying the voice of Jehovah. Just kind of the way that humans do. You know, kind of the way that we get to reasoning. Well, maybe God doesn't mean or intend, or, you know, maybe it's not all of, you know, maybe surely He didn't. And so, you know, Saul says here in chapter 15, 1 Samuel 15, beginning at verse 20, "And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of Jehovah, and have gone the way which Jehovah sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the devoted things to sacrifice unto Jehovah thy God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, Hath Jehovah as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Jehovah? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as idolatry and terrorful. Because thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah, he has also rejected thee from being king. And then, of course, it all comes on Saul, or maybe he really knew it to begin with. And Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of Jehovah and thy words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. So, you see here where that Samuel says, but you see, you rejected the voice of God. And Saul finally admits, well, yes, I obeyed the voice of the people. I did what they wanted to do. And now we find that not only does Samuel tell him that God has revoked the kingdom as far as any of his sons ever being kings, but he says now he's taken you. God no longer even recognizes you as king. And so God has revoked his anointing of you being king. As you have rejected the word of Jehovah, he has also rejected thee from being king. And so we see here that that's Saul's legacy, isn't it? That's his story. That's the history of Saul. That's what we know of him. And what is that? Well, there's this terrible flaw where he loses the right for his sons to be kings, and then he loses his right to be king. And all because, even though God clearly states to him at least twice that just take me at my word. Do what I call upon you to do. Just do that. And so we find, though, that Saul then is, as he rejects God, is rejected by God. So, even though we don't have the scriptures down here, we will look here then and we'll see David's character as it determines his legacy. So when we get to 1 Samuel, the 16th chapter, after God has, through the prophet Samuel, told Saul that he has been rejected as being king, that God then tells Samuel to go and to anoint a new king. And in the 13th verse, we read, and then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of Jehovah came mightily upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. And so that person that he anointed was David. And you may be familiar with the events surrounding that. That would be an interesting read for you just to be reminded of, or, you know, if you're not familiar, to go back and to read this. But we see that though David's anointed to be king, it's going to be another 13 years before he actually takes the throne. So from the time of his anointing to the time that he actually takes the throne, it's about 13 years. Now, we find that this gives not only time to reveal David's character like Saul's, because all of the things that we just read about Saul, that took place over a number of years now. And so we can look at this, and David has a number of years, and he then is able to, you know, consider, you know, well, what am I going to do with this? I've been anointed as king, but, you know, I don't have the throne. Saul is still on the throne, and, you know, what's he supposed to do with this? But not only that, like Saul, he also has a test of his character. Saul's test of character was, go and do as I've told you to do. Wait for me, was the first one, wasn't it? Wait for me. Well, I waited, but when you didn't get here by the time I thought you should have, because I was under all this pressure and I was afraid of, you know, what the enemies might do, then he says, I then, you know, folded. And so that was Saul's test. And then, of course, the Amalekites. That was Saul's test. Well, David, what's his test? Well, we go to the 18th chapter then of 1 Samuel. And we notice here just this summation in verse 9. And it says, and Saul was yet more afraid of David, and Saul was David's enemy continually. Now, just because God had revoked Samuel or Saul as being king doesn't mean that he still didn't have the throne, and doesn't mean that he still didn't have charge over the people and that the people still didn't follow him. Yes, he still had the throne. He still had charge over the people, and the people still followed him. But he sees that the people really love David. David's been successful. He sees that God's blessing David. And so it just summed up there, it says he was David's enemy continually. And so now you have the king, and you have all the people that follow him and his armies seeing you as their enemy. And that goes on for 7 more years at least. And maybe even longer. Some think maybe up to 15 years. It's all just how you can put together the chronology. But 7 years is quite a while, and especially for a young man that's like, hey, I've been anointed. I'm supposed to be there. You know, I'm supposed to be the man. I'm supposed to have the throne. You know, I'm supposed to be, you know, held as king type of thing. And yet you have the man who is the king chasing you all over the countryside. And so how's David going to respond to this? How's David going to react? This is going to be his story. This will end up being his legacy. Not that he was chased and pursued, but how he reacted to it. What he did in regards to all of this. Well, we find that David actually had opportunities to usurp his possession as the anointed one. And he could take the throne by force. All he had to do was kill Saul. And now he's presented with opportunity to do so. 1 Samuel chapter 24, beginning at verse 1. And it came to pass when Saul was returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, and there was a cave. Now Saul went in to cover his feet. Now David and his men were abiding in the innermost parts of the cave. I'm going to just kind of tell you a little bit bluntly here, because for years when I was a kid and stuff, he went in there to cover his feet. I had no idea what in the world was going on here and how susceptible Saul was. But he went in there to use the restroom. And number two. And so literally, he's caught with his pants down. That's covering his feet. I mean, he is very vulnerable back here in this cave, you see. And he doesn't have his soldiers in there. I mean, they're giving him some privacy. It's the king after all. You know, he let him go in there in his privacy. All right. Now, David and his men were abiding in the innermost parts of the cave. I know, must have been tough. And the men of David said unto him, behold, the day of which Jehovah said unto thee, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thy hand, and thou shalt do to him as it shall seem good, pardon me, unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, Jehovah forbid that I should do this thing unto my Lord, Jehovah's anointed, to put forth my hand against him, seeing he is Jehovah's anointed. Pardon me. So David checked his men with these words and suffered them not to rise against Saul. And Saul rose up out of the cave and went on his way. So here's an opportunity that David has to usurp the kingdom, to take it over. But he doesn't do so. And we find that people are encouraging him and telling him. I don't know for sure where they got that God had told David all of that. But anyway, at least, you know, he's been anointed as king. And the idea that Saul's his enemy, he has the right, you know, to destroy his enemy. I mean, he can make a case to justify, at least before people, what he has done in killing the king, right? But he doesn't do so, does he? And then again in the 26th chapter, in verses 1 and 2, and the Sephites came unto Saul in Gibeah, saying, doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakilah, which is before the desert? Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. We jump down here then to the sixth verse that says, "Then answered David and said unto Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Seruiah, a brother to Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the place of the wagons, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered up thine enemy into thy hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear to the earth at one stroke, and I will not smite him the second time. And David said unto Abishai, Destroy him not, for who can put forth his hand against Jehovah's anointed and be guiltless? And David said, As Jehovah lives, Jehovah will smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go down into battle and perish. Jehovah forbid that I should put forth my hand against Jehovah's anointed. But now take, I pray thee, the spear that is at his head and the cruse of water, and let us go. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's head, and they gat them away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither did any awake, for they were all asleep because of a deep sleep from Jehovah was fallen upon them. And you read down further, and you find in both of these cases that David then cried out unto Saul with some distance between them and said, Look, I could have killed you. Here's your robe. Here's a part of it that I cut off when you were in the cave. Here's your spear, and here's your cruse of water that was at your head while you were sleeping. And when you got up, it wasn't there. Well, the reason it wasn't there, because I was right there, and I could have killed you. And in fact, I wouldn't even had to. Abishai was going to be a faithful servant to me, and he was going to do it himself. He was going to take the curse upon himself. But I wouldn't let him kill you because you were God's anointed. Now notice this assessment of character by David when he talks about then where he and Saul are in this place and when David could have taken his life. Now in 1 Samuel chapter 26, beginning at verse 22, it says, And David said, Behold the spear, O king. Let then one of the young men come over and fetch it. Verse 23, he says, And Jehovah will render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. For as much as Jehovah delivered thee into my hand today, and I would not put forth my hand against Jehovah's anointed. So David said, Let righteousness judge between us. And Saul even admits, Well, you've been more righteous than me, David, in regards to these matters. Now, the point comes as to where does such character come from? What's the difference between Saul and David? Well, the proverb writer in 23:7 says that as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. And so, in a sense, our character comes deep from within. It comes from the heart. It comes from, you know, what we set our heart on. And that's the way that we will act. That's the way that we will behave. The world wants our heart. God wants our heart. Now, Proverbs 3, speaking about God wanting our heart and what we should do with it, says this, beginning at verse 3, says, Let not kindness and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them on the tablet of thy heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. You want to leave a good legacy, he says? Then, let kindness and truth, let them not forsake thee. Bind them on thy neck. Write them upon a tablet of thy heart. And you'll find good favor both before God and man. Trust in Jehovah with all thy heart. And lean not upon thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him. And he will direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear Jehovah and depart from evil. It will be health to thy navel and marrow to thy bones. When David's legacy is remembered by his son Solomon, over in 1 Kings 18, and I've only taken a couple of passages to demonstrate this. There are actually a few other times. But Solomon says this about his father David. He says, "Now it was in the heart of David, my father, to build a house for the name of Jehovah, the God of Israel." See, this is the legacy that even his son can recognize. The heart of my father was on Jehovah. He wanted to build this house that Jehovah would not allow him, but now he is left in charge for me to build. We find that David's heart is struck at his conscience because he wants to please God. We read there in 1 Samuel 24 and 5 that after he had cut the garment of Saul, it says he was struck in his heart because he had done this. He felt that it was shameful to have done this. We see later when David counted the people, that he numbered the people, that he was cut to his own heart because he had done this. These references keep coming back to David's heart being convicted of something. And when he did something that he believed to be wrong, his heart was convicted. And that is because we find that God told Saul through Samuel when he took away the kingship from him. He said, "I will find me a man who will be after my own heart." Acts chapter 13 and in verse 32 says that David was the man after God's own heart. Now, we note that David's heart was right, that it was where it should be. Now, that doesn't mean that David had some kind of emotional longing, you know, a love that's better felt than told. Let me see if I can explain this just a little bit. David's heart was where it was because, in a sense, he was courting God's heart. Just like a young man would court a young maiden. And that sounds strange to maybe you, but we find the Scriptures use images like that, even though I'm the one that said that, and so I'll have to take the responsibility and bear the accountability of making that comparison. But it's similar to the comparisons that the Scriptures make, that it's not necessarily made about David and God. But we know that because it talks about David being a man after God's own heart. What does that mean? He was courting God's heart. Or what do I mean by that? I mean that he was desiring the approval and affection of God. And David built his legacy upon that. What would God want? What would God have? Saul built his legacy upon what? Well, the people, popularity, celebrity, you know, making sure you keep your fame, you know, the way that the world sees things. And so Saul had the legacy of losing the kingdom for his sons and then eventually even for himself. David had the legacy that his sons would reign upon his throne, and that he would eventually then bring the son who would reign eternally upon his throne. And that son, of course, being Jesus the Christ, said on the night before he went to the cross, as he prayed unto the Father, Jesus said, "I glorified thee on earth." That was Jesus' goal, to glorify God on earth. And Jesus, "I glorified thee on earth, having accomplished the work which thou hast given me to do." So in short, you want to know how to write a good legacy? You know how to have a good history? You know how for your story to be good? You know how for your children and your friends and whoever else that's still living after you're gone to remember you? How that you'd want them to remember you? Well, I can tell you in short, just take the advice of the son of David. "I have glorified thee on earth." As the son of a distant father that said, I want God's own heart. Young or old, that's still what can be done. The invitation of Jesus Christ invites you not only to the forgiveness of sins, but it invites you to building and developing the kind of legacy that you'll be praised at and for generations to come. As the Lord invites you, so we invite you. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
Have thine affections been nailed to the cross.